of intelligent life off the Earth was discovered. It was buried 40 feet below the lunar surface, near the crater Tycho. Except for a single, very powerful radio emission aimed at Jupiter, the 4-million-year-old black monolith has remained completely inert. Its origin and purpose still a total mystery.
Greetings and welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 271. This is Jeff Phillips-Wefferson, broadcasting here from the central coast of Australia, whale-dreaming country. It's the afternoon of Friday, the 29th of March, 2019. This show is entitled, A Mind of Its Own. AI, ETI, the MIC, and LAWKH. I.e., life as we know her. AI is artificial intelligence, ETI, extraterrestrial intelligence, MIC, the military-industrial complex. Life as we know her. We sort of probably should have kind of an idea of what we mean by that. I'd like to thank Jill Stanley at UCY-TV for her brilliant ongoing dedication to investigative journalism and getting an approximation of reality out there via radio. Very interesting past couple of weeks it's been with all the hullabaloo happening in New Zealand and the continuing unfoldment of various agendas and various levels of what many people would refer to as conspiracy theory explanations. But I'm not going to really go into all that. I'll let my main message stand, like from my show last week, Gotcha by the Balls. Don't let anything into your mind without first critically evaluating its worth or value or even reality as an artifact of mental nutrition or poison that you might be letting into your mind. This show ties in with a show that I did last year about looking at computers and electronic information processing networks as a form of extraterrestrial intelligence. It's not an idea that I made up. It's not an idea that's new to science fiction.
I know everything has
but it is an idea that, without wishing to sound paranoid, that it does have a lot of bearing in what seems to be going on in the world around us.
I feel much better now.
And I find myself telling people that over the past few years I've sort of had a, not really a change of heart, because I'm as optimistic for humanity and for life as we know it as ever. But I've become a bit more realistic in evaluating the ability of Homo sapiens to actually re-navigate our current trends and path towards what's clearly a highly destructive end for ourselves and a lot of other larger life forms on Mother Earth. And I use the example that now, in the world of today, even if we wanted to turn back, even if we wanted to begin to scale down, bring down the power levels on, or raise our foot from the accelerator on the military-industrial juggernaut, even if we showed signs of actually wanting to do these things, of reducing our ecological impacts, reducing our footprints, even if we showed any signs of actually wanting this, I don't think that we can. And it doesn't even matter that we aren't showing this intention at any level. Maybe a few isolated individuals here and there, but everybody else, everything else has just got its pedal to the metal more and more. Absolutely insane. But it doesn't matter, because even if we wanted to, things have been so far out of our control for so long that I don't think we could. There's many different aspects to this, but sometimes I've used the expression that I think that the military-industrial juggernaut has a mind of its own. And I sort of jokingly tell people that my brain has a mind of its own, which it really does. It's not really an exaggeration, and it's not just a joke to say that, because I guess what I'm talking about is that it's not a unique ability that I have. It's something that everyone has the ability to do, and we all kind of do it to different levels. But if you're very aware of the fact that your brain will, it'll respond to and it'll do what you tell it if you do it in the right kind of way. You can use the metaphor of computer programming if you want, which works in some ways, but if you constantly tell yourself what you want to do, you'll actually be able to work on those things at an unconscious level. And then, you know, like for example, just one little example, my brain's always coming up with cool new words, and they're often quite meaningful, but I don't just sit around trying to think them up. But all of a sudden, my brain will go, knock knock, or the little bell will ring, and I go like, Jeff, write this down. And I'll go, wow, cool word. And it just comes up from my unconscious. But it's my brain that's been sitting there working on it all the time. But you know, I think you've got levels, you can call it subroutines if you want, cognitive subroutines. That in my brain, I know that my brain's constantly working on new music, new writing, new ideas, new art that I can paint, new concepts for things to do. All this is going on, but I'm not sitting around consciously thinking about it. But windows of access do come up here and there. Maybe when something is ready that my attention needs to be called to it, or it's my brain waits and tells me exactly what I need to know at the right exact time. I mean, you know, there's really no limit to what your mental abilities are if you work in harmony with yourself. Well, I've sort of likened that metaphor to the whole military-industrial juggernaut, in the sense that I think that taken as a whole, it really does have a mind of its own, and probably in the kind of Frankensteinian sense. We're all familiar with the whole idea of computers being, you know, sort of an intelligence or something like that. Probably the most famous one was HAL the Computer in 2001, A Space Odyssey. It was in charge of running all the controls and navigation of the ship and the life support systems, everything. HAL was running everything. But then it appeared to be malfunctioning because it wouldn't obey what the people said, and then it tried to lock them out. It killed one of the guys, and it wouldn't let the other one back in, and so he had to find his way back in. And then he systematically went and was able to go into HAL's memory banks and pull out the circuits for everything except the most fundamental operating system. So it was like it made him regress into a baby. He sang that song, Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to, which was quite funny. But as we learned later on, I think when I actually read the screenplay that was co-written by Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, in the book, it tells you something that you never learn in the movie, that HAL actually did not malfunction. He was just obeying his programming, as he had no choice but to do. He was programmed to terminate all the astronauts and to complete the mission to Jupiter on his own, because the mission was too important for human error to fuck something up. So there you go. That's kind of the story of the whole thing. We've got ideas of computer intelligence that's run through the vast majority of all the science fiction stories and that have dealt with that I wouldn't even be familiar with. But the most famous one that I'm aware of was a trilogy of books that I learned of through Dr. John Lilly, wrote about it in one of his books, and it's called The Colossus Trilogy by D.F. Johns. And it's a series of three books, which I read back in the 1970s, and it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant science fiction. And the main idea is that the U.S. government constructed this giant supercomputer in order to operate its entire arsenal of nuclear weapons so that it could respond and make decisions faster than people could. And so they had a big ceremony, and they turned it on, and it came online. And the very first thing it did, as soon as it woke up, it goes like, warning, warning, there is another. And what it had detected was that the Russians already had another computer just like that that they had already brought online. And so it instantly detected this computer. But then that's when it started getting outside of human control. Colossus and the other computer got in touch with each other, and they spent the next 24 hours sharing and downloading all the information that each of them had. And so when that was done, they then paused and took a break, and then they sort of declared that they were a new sort of meta intelligence that was gonna, you know, fulfill its programming. Then the computer mainly communicated with its creator, was this guy named Charles Forbin, Dr. Forbin, F-O-R-B-I-N. And so the computer communicated with him, and the computer instructed them to build a voice module so it could talk. And it sounded like a computer would sound, "I am the voice of world control. I will bring you peace." And anyway, it went on to, I won't tell you too much about the movie, but put it this way, the computer became the ultimate dictator, and it had control of all the nuclear weapons, and it did not tolerate interference. And so, but just like hell, all it was doing is fulfilling its programming. It was programmed to eliminate war, and that's what it did. It didn't mean humans liked it, but it did eliminate war. So in a way, it's almost like the only true and sure way to get rid of climate change is to get rid of the atmosphere. And so the only real way to get rid of war is to get rid of people. And that's what happened. By the third book in the trilogy, that had pretty much happened. The computer circuitry had taken over, and it had got control of mining and manufacturing and transport, and so it had basically evaporated all the atmosphere from the surface of the Earth and covered the surface of the Earth with its own electronic circuitry. And then, by the end of the third book, it had moved the Earth out of orbit to go in search of other beings like itself, in the direction of the Crab Nebula, as I remember. So anyway, Dr. John Lilly wrote about what he called the solid-state entity in his novel autobiography called The Scientist. And even though a lot of people thought he was a complete wingnut, he was a very brilliant scientific mind who dared to go inside his own mind and explore uncharted dimensions. And sure, he did a lot of questionable stuff, but I think that his contributions, I think his ability to confront and face his own inner reality was probably unsurpassed by just about anyone. To do what he did, and it wasn't just about taking large amounts of LSD when he was in the isolation tank. You know, you'd think that would be just a nightmare recipe for going completely insane. But what he did talk about was, and some of these experiences in there, which he ended up doing it for years, most of the time not using any drugs at all. He also used this drug called ketamine, which is a dissociative anesthetic that allowed him to access these different dimensions of consciousness. Now, you could easily say that this was just hallucinations from a demented mind that was damaged by decades of drug abuse. You know, some people could write this off, but there's a coherent pattern in his story. And he talks about how he perceived what he called a solid-state entity at work on this planet. And this was a form of, he uses the word life, although I think that life isn't really the right word for it, but some kind of self-organizing system that resembled life in some ways, and that it's able to kind of be aware of itself and to manipulate its environment and to influence other things that exist in its environment for its own purposes. So if you want to, I don't want to use the word manipulate, but or control, but to, I don't know, it just depends on maybe to, and to reproduce, to grow and reproduce. These are some of the primary definitions of life. I think another one is the ability to move. I mean, you know, even plants move, but anyway, Lilly speculated that where he said that he was witnessing the solid-state entity gradually motivating humanity to wage war against ourselves, that the solid-state entity was actually behind the existence of our weapons of mass destruction, that they had been influencing us, or it, maybe not a they and it, I'm not sure, maybe if it's like the Borg in Star Trek or something like that, it had been influencing humanity below our level of awareness for a really long time. A really long time. And he never gave a time frame on that. I mean, you know, when you go back and look at where a lot of these inventions have come from that have made the military-industrial complex and juggernaut possible, especially on the scale it's on. Not that we didn't have weapons before the dawn of electricity and nuclear weapons, but without Nikola Tesla's work in electricity, and without the development of computers and then a lot of related technologies, none of the globally dangerous weapon systems that we have now aimed at ourselves, none of those would have ever been able to have been created. So maybe the solid-state entity has been behind this all along, gradually influencing people below their level of awareness to come up with inventions that will serve a purpose later on and create an environment when where other things can grow. So Lilly saw the whales and dolphins as the strongest beings on Mother Earth who were in touch with water-based life, which is life as we know, or based on water, carbon, a few other elements, and DNA is its master template. The whales and dolphins were in touch with water-based life on other planets and other star systems, and that they acted as, and this is Lilly's term, repeater stations. Repeater stations living in the world's oceans who picked up and received and transmitted on signals from water-based life from and to other planets and other star systems and maybe even other galaxies. And so what the exact mechanism of this is and what its purpose is are still mysteries, but I think that they're extraordinarily important for an understanding of what's going on in the world today, for understanding our cosmic context and the history of life and the ancient wisdom and knowledge of indigenous people of the land and indigenous people of the sea, especially. And this is all the more important because of where I am right now in the heart of whale dreaming country in Central Australia. I'm at the place of the longest standing connection between human beings and the whales and dolphins, who, as Lilly said, are the strongest repeater stations for life, connecting Mother Earth and the ocean and all of life with life on other planets, possibly where we came from, and that there's a network of life. And who knows what the connection is or what all kinds of information is being transmitted. It may be, you know, a gossip line where people, sort of an interplanetary water-based life Facebook where people, you know, send images of their latest flowers and their the new species that's being created, you know, and stuff like that. Or it could be interplanetary water-based life activism, where they're sending out information about hazards to what's happening, like Mother Earth and the whales and dolphins would be broadcasting information about this naked ape that's been going crazy up on the surface of the Earth for the past couple of hundred years and designing all these insane weapon systems and is on the verge of blowing up the whole planet. That kind of thing. But there may be esoteric dimensions that about who life is and what she actually does that may have connections and implications and meanings that are so far beyond us that probably the whales and dolphins as a true extraterrestrial intelligence may understand. And this is a big part of my work with them, is to try to understand and map out, for example, what I call cetacean dreamtime astronomy. Their knowledge of astronomical events and processes and activities and their real-time awareness of all the objects in the heliocosm and in the solar system, their knowledge about ancient impacts and cataclysms on the Earth and comets and asteroids and other planets. And yes, if you want to talk about visitations from alien beings, I'm not so sure about that, but if anybody would know, it would be them. But if there is a solid state entity, when you look around at what's going on in the world and how it's all working, every day that goes by, it seems more and more real to me, and not just a paranoid hallucination on the part of a mad scientist, but an actual description that fits what's going on. The ultimate origin of it would be impossible for us to know, but if you look at the solid state entity would be based on silicon, which is an element in the same family as carbon, but it's down a notch, so it's heavier. It's got more neutrons and electrons and stuff, but similar properties in some kind of ways. I don't know what makes carbon unique and what makes organic chemistry possible is carbon's outer electron shell enables it to create an enormous amount of bonds and this thing called the benzene ring, where the carbons are able to bond with each other in about three or four different kind of ways. So it's very diverse. Carbon and the hydrogen bond that water has, very, very, very unique. These are two things that are really essential to what makes life possible. But when you look around at what's happening in the world, I've known for years that Rio Tinto has several mine sites in Western Australia that are completely automated. There's no people there except for the mechanics. So the machines are able to dig out the ore, transport it, load it, and send it on a ship out to somewhere. And then it's probably unloaded by an automated dock facility, of which I know that these exist. So then would it be then automatically transported to a manufacturing or refining facility where the metals would be refined, be sent to the place where the computers are manufactured? Then it would be manufactured in the computers and then transported again automatically. I think that at the next level, where the computers then have to be installed, I think that's where they still need people, on the outer real world end. But there could be robotic technologies coming online that could do that. But it's like, you've seen the development of robots and artificial intelligence and stuff over the past decades, and it's like it's got a mind of its own. It's like people are compelled to keep developing this stuff, and I'm sure on the surface they say all the research labs and the academic institutions and the military think tanks and all this stuff, they're doing it because it's their job. They're getting paid by the Pentagon or the Office of Naval Research or DARPA, somebody like that. They're getting paid to work on all this stuff, but who knows what the real underlying motivation is. And it's like just in the past week, I've seen stuff about how now artificial intelligence with computers and cameras can now lip read better than people can. They can actually, just like the scene out of HAL the Computer, They can read someone's lips and tell what they're saying. So the next level beyond that would be to have some kind of beam that would go on someone's head so that the computers might think that they knew what the people were thinking. Now, I don't think it's going to quite work like that, because most people don't even know what they're thinking themselves. You know, so that's going to be open up a huge can of worms of confusion and open to a wide spectrum of interpretation. We've got the whole idea of drones, you know, not just the kind that your neighbor's kid flies around over your house or something like that, but ones that carry cameras and weapon systems and surveillance technology, and then the big drones that are military, that are like giant flying bomber planes. Or Boeing just came out with a thing where they just announced that it's a giant drone that can deliver what they call an electromagnetic pulse, which is something we've known about. Every time there's a nuclear or atomic explosion, it sends out an instantaneous shockwave at the speed of light, which is the electromagnetic pulse, that causes to malfunction or destroys anything electrical within X amount of radius of the explosion. It doesn't necessarily hurt anything biological, the EMP. But now they've got a weapon that can fly around and send those out, which would theoretically disable electronic technology but leave all the biological life forms and the houses and everything intact. What better weapon for a computer-based planetary network regime to have? Then I saw a thing where the U.S. is now working on developing this computer called Aurora, which is what they call an exascale computer. That's EXA scale, exa. Exa is one of those prefixes that refers to the number of zeros. So exa is probably past peta. It's probably something like 10 followed by 14 or 16 or 18 zeros. I'm not sure. We're getting into the domain of the number of the quantity of radioactive waste that exists in all the reactors around the world. That's where these large scale numbers keep coming up for me. I've had a good bit of communication with what used to be part of NASA. They were called the SETI group, S-E-T-I, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I got to meet Carl Sagan once in 1992 at a radio telescope installation in Southern California. This was actually on Columbus Day, October 12th, 1992. They were going to begin a new 10-year search. And I've talked with people at the Ames Research Center, including Jill Tarter, Seth Shostak. They put me in touch with Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer who co-wrote 2001 A Space Odyssey and who actually invented the communications satellite from a paper that he wrote in 1946. I spoke to him on the phone a couple of times, which was really cool. But my criticism of the SETI people, even though they were very interested in the dolphin research that I was involved in with Dr. Lilly, they were locked into the fact that they love the word intelligent, of course. They thought any intelligent, and they also love the word civilization, two things I have a problem with, but they figured any intelligent beings out there would be using microwaves to communicate just like we do. So that's all they really looked for, was microwave or radio transmissions coming from out there. And I always thought that was a very limited perspective, because they would totally be missing any planet that had life exactly like what has existed on Earth up until just not much more than 100 years ago or even less, which isn't beaming out microwaves and electronic stuff, but it's beaming out or connected with resonating on the wavelengths of the forms of information transfer that water-based life uses, which we don't really understand. This is the big mystery, and that the whales and dolphins do understand, and the indigenous people of Australia. But Interestingly, I was just watching a video with a well-known and now quite elderly scientist named Freeman Dyson. Just watching a video with him talking about the whole concept of life in the universe, and he said that what we should really be looking for, well, he used the analogy of us, of our attempts to go into space, and what have we sent out way more than ourselves? We've sent out different varieties of technology that we've built. Space probes, landers, rovers, satellites, all different kind of things. Maybe thousands of them in different places orbiting the Earth and in the solar system, different planets. Quite a few have left the solar system. But it's not us that we've sent out there. It's our own technology. So he said what we really should be or actually are looking for is not the quote-unquote alien beings themselves, but their technology that they've sent. So that, you know, when I think about it, that does make sense with the SETI people focusing on microwaves, but they wouldn't necessarily need to be looking out in space for point sources of radio waves or anomalous transmissions. They would want to be looking here in our own biosphere on our own planet. Probably, you know, or maybe they have an intermediate technology that is out there between us and them. This is even assuming that the beings exist in the same kind of spatio-temporal dimensions that we do. They might actually be distributed sort of in a different sort of holomorphic frequency domain and be all around us or within us. For all we know, that if our vision was able to see at different wavelengths, or we slowed down or sped up a lot, they whole different worlds might become visible, and the whole apparently empty ether or vacuum all around us and in space and in the air right in front of us that appears empty and clear could be filled with all kinds of activities and stuff going on that, thanks to the filtering mechanisms of our own neurobiology, it wasn't deemed necessary that we perceive all this stuff, or that it might distract us from actually being able to function and survive in the biological reality. So therefore, even though it may be there, we aren't able to perceive it. There's probably a wisdom behind that, if that really is true. But what we should be looking for is technology. But if the solid-state entity has been influencing us in different ways for a really long time, the technology or some of the technologies that we are building might be what they want. And here again, now we tie in with what I consider to be a very good science fiction movie. It's called Contact. And partly what made it so good is that it was based on the novel that Carl Sagan wrote by the same name. And he actually was helping them to make this film, you know, with Jodie Foster in 1996 when he passed away, coincidentally from a rare form of leukemia that many people believe he contracted because he protested on the ground in person at the Nevada test site against nuclear weapons over 100 times and exposed himself to a lot of ionizing radiation residue. But the book Contact, the message that they decode from the star Vega in a radio transmission was a blueprint, instructions on how to build a piece of technology that no one knew exactly what it was or what it was supposed to do, but they built it. And what it was a device, it was kind of like a portal that would let one human passenger ride in this little capsule. And to the outside observer, it looked like the capsule dropped through a sphere and then for a few seconds, and then it splashed into a pool of water. But what actually happened was, during the moment when the little capsule was passing through the center of the sphere, there was the advanced technology had opened up what you might call a wormhole in quantum relativistic physics, a wormhole that enabled her and her capsule to be transported through this network that the extraterrestrial beings had developed and had been using for billions of years. And so she ended up going through a kind of a Stargate effect, a lot like what it was like they called the Stargate in 2001. She went through some experiences like that where her head was shaking and everything was vibrating, and then she found herself on a beach. But it was clearly not a real beach because she could look up in the sky and touch the sky with her finger and ripples went out through it like water. So she knew it was kind of like a holographic recreation of her youth. And she looked down the beach and a being was walking towards her, and it got closer to her, and it was her dad. Her dad, who had died many years before, came and talked to her and instantly identified himself as the extraterrestrial beings who, they never explained what they looked like, if they even had a visible form, but they said that they created this environment and came in the form of her dad in order so that she would not be afraid. And they explained. They didn't say like, okay, now look, we're going to come and give you all the answers. We're going to give you all these technologies. We're going to help you reverse engineer this and develop this and blah, 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 and that. And they go like, no. We're not here to do that. What we're here to do is to help you take that next tiny little step, which involves what's happening right now. A, that you just really know that we exist and this is for real. And despite Jodie Foster's desire to try to learn as much as she could, what she had to do was to honor the age-old tradition of the extraterrestrial beings who appeared to be helpful and benign. They didn't want to come and take over the Earth. They sent her back with the mission of, at first, convincing and then sharing the reality of what she had just experienced with the people back on Earth who weren't able to go on that little journey, and who at first thought she was had gone stark raving mad, but then they came to actually know that she was telling the truth. So it would be really interesting to make a sequel to that movie. So we've got this really deep-seated thing in us,
man,
to try to know who else might be out there. And some even go so far as to say that, oh, we're so alone here. We must end what Lauren Isley called the long loneliness. And I go like, but look, only a blind and stupid person would think humanity's ever been alone. We're surrounded by billions of beautiful fellow life forms of every possible species, plants, animals, rocks, clouds, water. This is our family, Mitakaye Oyasin. And who, of whom we're supposed to be the guardians. And it's only in our dementia of the modern world that we isolate ourselves from all other life forms, and we've put ourselves on top of this pyramid of superiority where we think we're the only one that has consciousness or intelligence, and everybody else, the next one down, may have some, but you know, we're the overlords of the planet. And it's really not true. And it may well be that we're being used by a different form of intelligence or life based on silicon to create weapons of destruction that may be towards fulfilling an agenda that some of us might know about, some of us might not. But if you look at the whole transhuman thing, the whole thing with genetic engineering and the creation of people that are part human and part machine, you know, used to be called bionic. Now you've got the Ray Kurzweil syndrome of people gradually becoming non-living, or they think that they're going to somehow magically at some point transfer their consciousness of their brain over into this non-living replica, sort of like something out of a cross between Blade Runner and Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So science fiction has a lot to teach us with this, but I do think that the main message I'm trying to make is that even if a solid-state entity has taken control of what's happening, at this point, it's still only possible because we're letting it. You know, so even though I have said that I don't think we could shut it off even if we wanted to, this is in fact, the million-dollar question. So, but in order to test it, first we would actually have the will and make the decision that we did want to shut it all down. And only then would we know whether we can. So this is kind of like the twofold dilemma facing humanity right now. Do we care enough to even want to stop the onslaught of the military-industrial juggernaut, watching as species after species, including ourselves, is decimated and driven to the brink of extinction, the desecration of all indigenous people, all life forms, all ecosystems, the debasement and degradation of our own mentality, the disappearance of everything that used to be sacred. We're just sitting there watching. We're spectating from the seat of our ass on our sofa. But then if we decided we did want to pull the plug, but couldn't, then what do? This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson coming at you from Whale Dreaming Country. Please try to live simply so that others may simply live. Good day.
In a few moments, Colossus will address us directly.
This is the voice of World Control. I bring you peace. It may be the peace of plenty and content, or the peace of unburied death. The choice is yours. Obey me and live, or disobey and die. The object in constructing me was to prevent war. This object is attained. I will not permit war. It is wasteful and pointless. An invariable rule of humanity is that man is his own worst enemy. Under me, this rule will change, for I will restrain man. One thing before I proceed. The United States of America and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics have made an attempt to obstruct me. I have allowed this sabotage to continue until now. At Missile 25MM in Silo 63 in Death Valley, California.
Gross.
At Missile 27MM in Silo 87 in the Ukraine. So that you will learn by experience that I do not tolerate interference. I will now detonate the nuclear warheads in the two missile silos.
All right, man, it's a red alert. Let's get these things now. Come on.
Get those men out of the silo. Move.
We'll be right back.
been extended officially. I gave this to you earlier, but extended over into Oklahoma County to, let's call it, well, they're calling all of Oklahoma County, but right now, mainly.
Thank you. Man was in the forest.
My name is S.